Texas area. It's Let's Talk with your host, Eric Jackson. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And now, here's your host, Eric Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello out there, and welcome to Let's Talk. I'm your host, Eric Jackson. I'm back after a one-week hiatus, y'all, and boy, am I glad to be back. You hear me? I missed you. Hope you missed me, too. Hey, today is Monday, the first day of the work week. Hope you had a great weekend. Now, today we're going to be talking about, today is Open Mic Monday, and Open Mic Monday means we can talk about anything and everything we want to. So if it's on your mind, trust me, we can talk about it. Without a doubt. Now, with that being said, let me get a shout out to my Jacksonville Jaguars because they rocked up in New Orleans this last weekend. Hey, we 2-0 in preseason. I know y'all say preseason don't count, but it counts for me, especially when we're winning the games, right? Y'all know how that go. But okay, with that out the way, let's go on and get talking about our topic today. What I'm going to start off with anyway. Now, if you want to join in the conversation, you got something you want to talk about? No problem. Just give me a call at 347-838-8622. Email me at ericletstalk@gmail.com. Or you can hit me up in my chat room, which is open. Just go to your media favorite media site and log in. And we can have a conversation in the chat room as well. Okay. So now, with that being said, let's get started talking. And today, I really didn't, after being gone for a whole week, you would think you have a lot to talk about when you come back. But in some cases, it was okay because I really had enjoyed myself more than I tried to do some work. But okay, I took care of the work part too. And, just going over some things, being a veteran, I saw something that really, really, really bothered me. Our veterans, man, I tell you, we something else. We work hard, whether when we in and when we out. So when I noticed that the suicide rate for July, man, that was, oh, my goodness. Do you know the suicide rate alone, 26 active duty soldiers killed themselves in July. Now it's just compared to 12 in June. So my question is, what is going on, y'all? Why are our young men and women coming back, surviving the war, but yet not surviving here in the United States, taking their own lives? What is going on with that? Granted, we understand, you get out and things aren't the same, but is, and some of them, this says active duty. And this was the Army. This is just the Army. That's the scary part. This is just the Army. The Marine Corps had 8 suicides in July, up from 6 in June. And that is 32 Marines. And this is what, August now? And that's just, that was the total for the entire year of 2011 for the Marines. What is going on with our military? The Air Force had 6 compared to June, 2 in June. The Navy had 4 in July. Of course, the Army numbers are higher than, any of the other services, but why? Is it because they're a bigger branch? Maybe that's what it is, because they're a bigger branch. But my question is, what's causing this? Why are we having this problem with our soldiers, our young people, taking their lives? And being a veteran, I know, there's supposed to be services out there, and you're supposed to go and see this person. That's fine for when you get out, but what about when you're in? Why are you still in active duty? Because even when I was in, you didn't want to go and say you had to go and see the psychiatrist or the shrink or whatever you want to call it. You didn't want to say that because it was held against you. Of course, on the upside, they say, no, well, go ahead and get the help you want. And I'm not going to fib. I went and did that. I went and tried to get some help, and I was told everything was fine with me. Now, everything was fine after deploying, what, 9 times? But I was fine. I didn't have a problem. That's what I was told. So imagine what these soldiers are being told, because it's a numbers game now. It's a numbers game. So the more people they got boots on ground over there, the better off they feel. But yet we got soldiers coming home, killing themselves, going on killing sprees. Heck, some of them not even getting home, and they going on killing sprees over there. What is that all about? You know, what is that about? And why? No, and what is the military doing about this, huh? What is the military doing about it? I tell you, the military, the U.S. Army grants $3 million for anti-suicide nasal spray research. Now, this nasal spray research. Now, come on, y'all. Nasal spray? And they just grant research? So what about our soldiers and sailors and Marines that's coming home right now? What you going to do for them right now? You know, and they awarded some scientists at Indiana University School of Medicine. School of Medicine. And they're giving him 3 years. 3 years to ascertain whether the nasal spray is a safe and effective method for preventing suicide. So, up for the next 2.5-3 years, what are we going to do then about our soldiers? What are we going to do until then? I understand we're trying to help in the future, but what about now? What about now? Say 38 soldiers in the Army. And that's just, man, 66. The Army has confirmed 66 active duty suicides. Now, they have confirmed 66. They're actually investigating 50 more. You know, for a grand total of 116 cases, suicide cases. You know, that's more American soldiers taking their own lives than the ones over there in Afghanistan being killed by the Taliban. Why? Why? What are we doing? Yes, everybody come back. You know, back in the day, they used to call it shell shock. But are these soldiers shell shocked? You know, I mean, they shell shocked, right? That's the problem. They're coming home, they're having financial issues. Why are they having financial issues? We're going to look at it like this. Okay, they come home, they didn't survive. No telling how many times they've been out, downrange, kicking in doors, avoiding landmines, IEDs, being shot at. Watching somebody being shot, the buddies dying. So they survive all that in Afghanistan, Iraq, wherever they are. Then they come back. Then they come back here to United States of America, home. You hear me? They come home just to take their own lives. You know, when I was in, they used to have this thing called reintegration training, where you go, you couldn't do anything when you got back until you had to go and go through this gauntlet of doctors and things. You know, now here's the catch with that. You back, you so ready to go home. You know, and it's just a survey they give you. You fill out some paperwork. Yeah, you're filling out some paperwork. Now, while you filling out this paperwork, you know, you marking, and you're looking at the lines like, man, these are long lines. So at the end, you know, you got the psychiatrist and other type doctors sitting there, and they ask you straight up, well, do you think you need to see a psychiatrist? Now, you sitting there with your buddies on the left and right of you. You know, they saying no. So there's peer pressure. What you going to say? No, I'm okay. Even though you may think you may need it. Because, you know, that's a stigma that gets put on them soldiers. Man, so-and-so crazy. You know, he said he had to go and see a psychiatrist over there. You understand what I'm saying? So what are we doing here in the United States when they come home? Okay, we're making sure they're safe, and we trying to get them as home as fast as we can. Okay, we're doing that over there. But what about once they get here? They done gone through this so-called reintegration training. They done been evaluated and all this. But yet, they go home 2 or 3 months later, they're killing themselves. Why? Why? And that, I think that's the puzzling thing. Everybody's putting their little separate nixes on it and everything. You know, they're like, well, you know, some of them having financial issues. Some of their wives and girlfriends left them. And is that the real reason why? You know, as I mentioned before, back in the day, everybody had this saying that said shell shock. They were shell shocked. Let's see, I got a call of Mike. Let me see what Mike got to add to the conversation today. Hello, Mike. Thank you for calling Let's Talk.
Howdy.
What's on your mind?
Well, as a veteran myself, I've had a few friends that have committed suicide after coming back from Iraq.
Right.
And I'll tell you exactly why it happens.
Okay.
Because, first of all, one guy, he killed himself because his wife left him while he was deployed.
Uh-huh.
And that's what he put in his note. What a load of shit that is. People have their wives and girlfriends leave them all the time. And the United States has one of the lowest suicide rates per 100,000 in the world. So, they're just not dealing with it. You're not dealing with someone that's mentally stable in the first place. People have their girlfriends and wives leave them all the time, and they're not killing themselves. But why are people from the Army doing it? Why are people from the Marines doing it? Why are people from the Navy doing it?
That's my point exactly. What is going on? You know, and being a veteran yourself, what branch were you in?
I was in the Air Force for 10 years.
Okay. Well, I don't know how the Air Force, you know, is, but I know when I was in the Army, you know, once we got back, we had to go through this I guess they call it training, you know, where we had to go in front of the doctors, fill out a little survey. And like I said, even though something was bothering you, you know, there was this stigma that was put on if you sat there and said, yeah, I need some help. You know, is that still what's going on in the military today? You know, have we still not gotten past that point of it?
Well, as far as stigma is concerned, you don't have to say anything during that reintegration stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, if you get down into the nitty gritty of all the different services, if you have an appointment at the hospital, you know, like the on base hospital, or if you go to a hospital at another base. Because your base doesn't have a hospital, your supervisor is required to release you for that day, no matter what's going on, unless you're in the middle of like an exercise or something. So if you say, I have a medical appointment at the hospital, they don't have to know what it's for.
Well, you're right, and that's the way it used to be, but
that's the way it is now.
It's still the same way now, then.
So when people say, oh, I don't want to go to see mental health because there's a stigma.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's right. If you go around telling people, oh, I'm having nightmares every night, and I think about killing people, and I'm going to see a psychiatrist 2 times a week, then, of course, there's a stigma. But if you say, I'm going to the hospital, then they're still required to release you. Even if they say, oh, what are you going for? What are you going for? It's none of your business. The only person that has access to your medical records is your commander or anyone
right.
that you... You have to sign a paper saying, I released this person. Like, if your supervisor wants to see him and you agree to that, you could sign a paper saying, my supervisor so-and-so can see my medical records. But if you don't sign that paperwork, the only person that can request that is your commander. And that's only to determine eligibility for deployments.
Hmm. Okay, Mike.
For duty.
All right. But that's a very good point. And with that being said, then, if that same soldier is running around saying all this, would that be considered a cry for help? Or you see what I'm saying? If you walk around saying, well, I got to go and see a psychiatrist, or I'm having nightmares, what have you, and everybody's like, yeah, whatever, man, we having the same thing, you'll be all right.
See, but that's only if you tell other people what you're going through.
Mm-hmm.
And I did computers for 10 years, so I can't speak to how it is in a combat unit, but I can't imagine that even in a combat unit, everyone is so in everyone else's business where they know what you're going to the hospital for. They know what your doctors are telling you. I mean, I can't believe that there'd be that much personal information shared. I mean, sure, you tell people about your family back home and you talk about hobbies and stuff, but I can't believe that they sit there and be like, he's going to the hospital and we don't know what it's for.
But you know what, Mike? I mean, you're right, but here's my point with this. Okay, so if that's the case then, and everybody's not, and maybe that's what the problem is. Maybe we should require, that they should see more, you know, have a soldier speak out more instead of holding everything in. You know, it's that way they don't have to make this. Maybe somebody can see what's going on and make that decision for them and get them to see some help.
Well, I don't want to disparage veterans or people that are currently serving, but the services are there to use. And if you're not using them, that's not anybody else's fault but your own.
That is a good point. But
I mean, there are ways around the stigma. I agree. There's definitely a stigma. If you're going out and saying, I'm seeing a psychiatrist once or twice a week, people are going to start, what's he seeing a psychiatrist for? But if you have a hospital appointment once a week and you say, I'm going to the hospital, I'm seeing a doctor, they say, what's that for? It's none of your business. It's none of your business. Sure, they'll be like, oh, what's he going to the hospital for? But they're not going to automatically assume, oh, he's crazy.
Well, you know, the big thing now is post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, back in the day, it was shell shock. Nobody wanted to be shell shocked. Now, you know, it has graduated to a whole different term now.
PTSD. Now everybody wants it.
Exactly. You know, so, you know, and that, once again, it goes back to, okay, man, you're just trying to set yourself up for VA once you got, man, go on back to work. You know what I'm saying?
Well, in some cases, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it is. Like I said, I've never been in a combat unit, so I can't speak to that. But I did two tours of duty in Iraq, and I did it in a tent on a rear base away from combat. I never had to get in my Ken gear. I never had to take cover in a ditch because they were having mortar attacks, nothing like that.
Okay.
It was a cushy deployment in an air-conditioned tent, managing servers 12 hours a day on my off time.
Right.
I did video games.
No,
two
okay.
people that I was deployed with came back. Oh, I have post-traumatic stress syndrome. What in the holy fuck are you on?
You know what? I mean, it's not funny, but I understand what you're saying. I do understand. See, myself, I was
folks coming back, and they were the ones kicking down doors, and they were the ones, you know, feet on the ground, eyes on target. Those are the kind of people that you want coming back and taking advantage of the PTSD stuff. But then
right.
have that diluted by these. Really cushy Air Force fucks. And they come back, oh, I have post-traumatic stress disorder. I worked in an air-conditioned building. I never had to face combat, but I'm stressed.
You know, I'm laughing, but, you know, being a soldier in the Army, that's what we used to say about the Air Force. I hate to laugh, but, you know, like, really? But, you know, back to the subject, though, but how, you know, we have to... The military period has to have to develop something to be able to, unless we just require everybody to go and see somebody when they get back.
See, and that's what they're doing with this nasal spray. I mean,
uh-huh.
You can say, oh, you can tell someone, hey, here's a pill, take this pill, but they have to take it once a day and no one's going to monitor them doing it. If that's their antidepressant, you know, and they're not taking it, that's on them. But on the flip side of that, if you have an antidepressant nasal spray, which studies have shown, I don't know with antidepressants, but generally speaking, if you take a nasal medication, that gets in your bloodstream faster. And so if you have a nasal spray, you can sit there and do that in front of your supervisor. Your supervisor says, do your nasal spray right now, and suddenly everyone in the Army is on antidepressants. They're once-a-day nasal spray.
Okay, so then we have a whole military that's just walking around calm like zombies. Is that really the answer?
Antidepressants do different things.
Right, depends on the person.
Oh, and depends on the medication, too.
Right.
But I understand what you're saying. But that's the kind of thing they want to have. They want to have this kind of thing available so when people are starting to like show signs of depression, even if they're not talking about it, they have this tool available. Open the first aid kit and get out the nasal spray. It sounds ridiculous, but it'll work. It really will work if people do it.
Mm.
So I agree. It seems kind of ridiculous on on one side, and, oh, they're spending all this money for the future, but if it pans out, if these antidepressants can get in your bloodstream nasally,
those allergy medications,
it works for a couple other things.
Right.
So if it can work for antidepressants, this could potentially be huge for the military.
You're right. It'd be a godsend. But we're talking about 3 years from now. 3 years from now. What about now? You know, what, 26 active duty soldiers, just soldiers in July. That's a lot of soldiers killing themselves. I mean, we're not talking about going out killing each other. They're killing themselves.
Well, and you get that a lot of times people join the military, any branch, because you get the GI Bill and you get a steady paycheck and you get free health care and dental care and you get BAS and BAH and all the benefits. And if you go overseas to the deployed location, you get combat pay and hazard pay and it's tax-free and all this stuff.
Yay.
And they're not thinking, oh, I'm joining the military where I'm going to have to go kill somebody and fight for my life potentially every day. They're thinking, I'm getting benefits. And then suddenly they realize, oh, shit, I have to work for that. I'm not saying that to everybody, but that was you see that a lot in the military. You think, oh, I'm just doing it for the GI Bill, and suddenly you're in Iraq, and you're like, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah, you're right. And that happened a whole lot. Man, I ain't come in for this. Oh, yes, you did. When you raised your right hand and signed that contract, this is exactly what you signed for.
Exactly. No matter what branch. I mean, that's one of the reasons I got out of the Air Force is because I had no combat training. They taught me how to use computers and manage servers and do computer scripting and stuff like that. And when the Army had a shortfall, they started taking people like me out of the Air Force with no training, saying, you're going to augment the Army.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know what, and here's the thing, because it became a boots on the ground. You know, it was no longer whether you qualify or not. We need numbers on the ground. We need boots on ground. You know, we'll show you the quick method of doing something, but this is what we need. And maybe that's what it, you know, I need to go back and look a little bit and see what is the age of a lot of these suicides. Because I'm curious about that. Is there a certain age that's more vulnerable?
No, generally it's people, it's 18 to 25-year-old males that are doing this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do believe it said they were all males, which is interesting. Yeah. Said, let me look that up. But, you know, and that leads something else. Why is it majority males and not females? No, because
well,
I know that.
This is going to be a sexist kind of thing to say, but females can get out of deployments real easy. You get your deployment notice. Oh, I'm pregnant. I saw that a ton in the Air Force, and I bet that's common in the Army, too.
Well, in some cases, unless you was in a unit like mine, and you're like, no, we use you in the office somewhere, but you're still going up to a certain, you know, a certain point. Let's see. Out of the 26 active duty soldiers who committed suicide in July, all were male, and only two were officers. Let's see. 13 were married, 10 were single, and 3 were divorced. A breakdown of deployment history of 14 of the 26 showed that 6 had never deployed, 7 had been deployed between 1 and 3 times, and 1 had been deployed 6 times. And that's just out of the 26 in the Army. So there's really no besides they all being male. You know, there's no really specific cause looks like. I mean, you know, thing that sticks out at you.
Did it mention their age at all?
No, it didn't mention any age. No age at all.
Because generally, this is true for the Air Force. I don't know about the other services, but the people that committed suicide in the Air Force were male from 18 to
25. Hmm. I mean, and that's possible. That's more than possible. The young men that joined up, you know, like you say, straight out of high school, got caught up in the after the 9/11 thing, joining up and, you know, being hoorah and just wasn't ready for it. But even so, that's a whole lot of people killing themselves after going overseas, deploying, surviving all that nonsense over there, because if some mess goes on over there, you see some things, you know, and to come back and kill yourself. And now just for us to decide that we're going to go ahead and try and get a nasal spray going now? What is it? What else is there? What can we do? What else can we do?
Well, this is where you're going to run into a problem. It's kind of like rape in the military. Everyone knows that it's wrong, and everyone knows it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the leaders are like, this is a problem. Make sure everyone's aware of it. Do more training. Supervisors be on alert for this. And it still happens. There's really not anything they can do short of forcing everyone to take a nasal spray. That's
well,
what they're looking at now.
Well, you know what? We need to hurry and get that nasal spray out then. You know,
well, they have to do FDA testing.
Exactly.
Drug testing is a whole process.
And that's my point. You know, they say within 3 years, but who says it's going to be even ready to be tested in 3 years? You know, so I think we need to actually look at another option besides that. You know, of course, that's $3 million going just for that one. You see what I'm saying? You know, it's like they're rushing. They want to rush a rush job done, but who's going to say it's going to be ready then?
Well, that's the thing with the military. It doesn't have to be ready then because they're allowed to use experimental drugs and stuff on recruits. That happens. Mm. You're not allowed to sue the military for any type of medical malpractice because of the Fair's Doctrine. It was meant to shield battlefield medics. And, you know, they amputated my leg on the battlefield. They could have taken me to a surgery room somewhere in Germany and did this and this and this. And then, of course, you had the battlefield medics thing. Well, that wasn't an option. We were getting shot at, and we had to stop the bleeding right then. So it was meant to shield those guys, but it's evolved over time so that you can't sue the military for medical malpractice. And so because of that, and it's also in part of your most people's enlistment contract, that you sign away certain rights to sue for certain things. So they can use things that aren't fully developed or, like, tested. Like the anthrax vaccine that they used back in the 70s. That was killing people.
Tell me
people
about it.
People died because it wasn't a tested vaccine. It didn't have FDA approval because they're not required to have it.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of this testing, all they have to do for this nasal spray is show that antidepressants can be delivered into the bloodstream via the nose, and that's it. They're done. That'll take some time with testing on mice, and then they'll do probably testing on other primates and whatnot, and they get the permits for that take years, a couple of years. But once they can reliably say, oh yeah, this gets delivered into the bloodstream nasally at 100% success or even 90% success, their portion is done. They can start deploying it like crazy. you can say, oh, everyone take your antidepressant pill at the same time. How many people are going to put it under their tongue and say, oh, I swallowed it, and then spit it out later?
You're right, because I did that during the Gulf War with some pills they wanted us to take. So you're absolutely right.
With a nasal spray, stick up their nose and you spray it, and it dissolves into their bloodstream immediately, and they can't spit it out. They're forced to have it.
That's a good thing, Mike. And you know what I'm thinking now? How about, you know, just before we even go over there, go on and, you know, give us a couple of shots, you know, when you first arrive and then during the middle of it, you know, maybe a preventive measure instead of just waiting till after the fact.
Well, as far as antidepressants, they have a very short life in the bloodstream.
Right.
I think the most potent one is a week. So you'd have to get a shot every week or even every day, depending on the medication.
No,
that'd be
no.
ridiculous.
Yeah, that'd be crazy. No, I'm not saying like that. Well, maybe, like I say, before you get ready to go over, you know, now depending on your tour over there. Okay. If you stand a year, maybe 6 months later, you know, not the regular small doses, enough to stay in the bloodstream just for a little while, just depending on what your MOS or specialty is.
So I'm not an expert on the drugs, but I'm not sure that there's a safe amount that they could give them.
Yeah, well,
so they wouldn't
yeah,
bloodstream for a long time.
You know, and that does depend a lot on the body weight and stuff too. I would suppose. You know, but it's interesting. I mean, because and then they have all these symptoms as far as PTSD. You know, and I'm looking and I'm like, okay, some people can they fake these symptoms to actually get medicine they don't really need?
Well, it's not even the medicine. It's after they separate, the VA benefits. There were people that I deployed with in the military. There's two people that I know of off the top of my head that are at 50% VA disability. They'll get a VA check and free VA medical care for the rest of their life because they said, oh, I have PTSD. And they were playing Halo for 12 hours a day. What the hell are they?
Oh, you know what, Mike? I like you because you tell it like it is. You actually telling the truth on that. You know, and you're right, because, and for veterans like myself that actually, you know, had to do something over there involving seeing action and all that, rolling
you're the ones that actually need the VA stuff, because you're the ones that'll have nightmares for the rest of your life. You're the people that, like, any time you hear a loud noise, you think, oh, I'm getting shot at. I mean, I don't know if that's you specifically, but that's, like, in general. It's stuff you saw
right.
Guys from Vietnam and the Vietnam syndrome and all that stuff. And that's what we're starting to see with the guys that have been done multiple tours in Iraq. You know, you're
right.
On the ground every day, you're dodging IEDs, like, oh, shit, there's a tripwire. You gotta detonate that shit. Kicking down doors and shooting people and having cars come at you and you have to shoot out their engine block. There's all kinds of stuff you hear about that they have to deal with every day, and they have to have 100% situational awareness at all times, and that shit messes with your head. And those are the people that you want to have the benefits because it really does limit the kind of things they can do in the civilian world.
You're right. If you can function at all, you know,
you can't even do. There was a thing in where I live in Palmdale, California. There was a guy that got a job after getting out of the military. He did like four tours of duty in Iraq. He got a job at a mechanic shop, and they had an impact hammer for some reason, and he thought he was getting shot at and pulled out his handgun and shot the guy with the impact hammer.
Wow.
I mean, just because he's just so used to you hear and you react. I mean, I don't know exactly what you guys do, but that stands to reason that if you're getting shot at, you would return fire. I mean, that's the logical thing to do, and if he thinks he's under attack, he's going to, of course, defend himself. So that's the kind of thing you hear about all the time from people that have been on the ground in Iraq and actually did the job that the Army is supposed to be doing over there.
You're right.
And those are the people that need the benefits and need the psychiatric help and need the, you know, if they were a mechanic before they went in, that may not be something that's viable for them to do. Or they may not be able to do things with loud, surprising noises. And that limits the kind of things that they can, the jobs they can get. So they need to have the supplemental income from the VA. It's not for these guys that sat behind in, like, Saudi Arabia and not even in a combat zone. Like, oh, I have PTSD now. Fuck those guys. But seriously, the people that need it should get it. And there's so much fraud that goes on now regarding PTSD that it's almost a cliche. Everyone that comes back now has PTSD.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems that way. You know, and, you know, now... You know, and I'm not knocking the Vietnam veterans, even, you know, some of them getting in on it, which some of them really do need it, just like the veterans coming back now. And, you know, I need to go back and do a little bit much more research and see, you know, did they have this suicidal problem as well when they started coming back? I know it was a little bit different.
They didn't really start tracking this until the mid-90s.
Yeah, exactly.
And even after that, well, again, I don't know how it is for the Army. But in the Air Force, when someone kills themselves, it's a stigma on the commander and on the whole chain of command that this person worked for. So they do a cursory investigation and they go, oh, we don't know if it's a suicide or not. It could be foul play. So even the suicide numbers they have aren't accurate.
You see, the Army didn't start reporting suicides by month until 2009. So, yeah. But, that would be something to compare to then and now. I mean, of course, it was two different types of wars. But I was just wondering. Well, many of them came back, you know, I ain't going to say shell-shocked, but addicted to drugs as well. So maybe it was just a different era. Same problem, just a different area.
Well, and you're right. It's a different area because in Southeast Asia, where they were at, there's all kinds of crazy drugs you can get there. And you get a bunch of guys with a lot of income, with like they're getting the combat pay and the hazard pay and their base pay and whatever else they get, and nothing to spend it on. They're out there in the field, and the only thing they can do is buy bootleg alcohol and the drugs.
Oh, man. Don't tell me about the bootleg alcohol, because, you know, I just have to get on my soldiers all the time, man. Y'all leave that stuff alone. You don't know what you're drinking over there, you know. But you know what? Now, knowing when I was in, we had females in our unit, and they did the same thing we did. And so they was in the mix as everything, you know, with all the rest of us. But my question is, maybe we need to study the female mind or makeup and see why aren't they going through this problems these young males are going through. Maybe it's something in between the makeups of the two of them that maybe can be switched over. Well, you know what I mean. Not really switched over, but, you know,
my position on this is really, really sexist, and I've taken a lot of flack from women about this. But it's so easy for a woman in the military to get out of a deployment or to get a cushy job. Mm-hmm. You know, you go overseas, and, you know, if you're a woman and you get deployed, the guy that that's going to assign you the job that you're going to do, he's been over there for 5 or 6 months, hasn't been laid. You know, give him a blow job and he'll give you a cushy office job for your 6 or 8 month deployment. I mean, it is 1,000 times easier for a woman to either get out of a deployment or while deployed get a non-combat job, like basically the cushy office jobs. It's so much easier for them to do it than it is for a guy. I mean, can you imagine a guy going, "Oh, dude, if you give me an office job, I'll suck your dick."
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty much. That's pretty true. We got to keep the language clean now. You know, daily show. But I understand your point exactly. Yeah. I mean, I really understand your point. And you know, but we need to do something. I mean, besides read about this every day. I mean, you know, every day there's something going on. If they're not killing themselves, they're killing each other. You know, but what can we do? Okay, they're taking steps for the nasal spray, but what about now? You know, VA has already said they don't have the therapists or, you know, the doctors, the psychiatrists to work with it. So do we need to bring more outside people in?
I think a lot of it is because of the fraud. A lot of people like once they're separated, they like having the VA benefits. And not just the paycheck, but they like going in and they're like, "Oh, these are my military buddies." You know, they have their own little community. And they go in, they see the same people every week at the VA clinic. And it becomes like their weekly routine to go in and see the psychiatrist and talk to their buddies there. And like, a lot of people, where I'm from, there's not a VA clinic here in Palmdale. They commute down to Sepulveda. And it's like an hour drive. And it's like their own little social group. They all go to the clinic together, and they all have a great time. They stop for lunch on the way back. It's like a social activity for them.
Really?
Wow. And that's the kind of thing you get when you have such rampant VA fraud. You get these people that they go in and say, "Oh, it's my benefit, so I get to use it whenever I want." And they go in and they take resources from people that genuinely need it.
That's interesting. That is very, but it's true. It is true. You know what? I said something about that before. You know how you see certain people walking around town every week, but every time you see them at the VA office, they got a walker or a cane or something like that. You know, you're like, "Really, guy?" You know, weren't you just on the softball field last week running around? So yeah, you have a very valid point. You have a very, and you know, now not letting the VA off the hook. You know, yes, it's some, but you know, in some cases, the VA, you know, I don't know. Sometimes they look at things a little bit different, I guess you can say. You know, they really, you know, some of the doctors actually do not feel there's something wrong with the soldiers. You know, because the VA just recently, some of the psychiatrists in the VA, actually the VA hospitals, have recently, I know here in Fort Hood, recently started being allowed to see active duty soldiers. You know, because before it was all kept on post. Now, here's the problem with that. A lot of the veterans were upset because they were saying, "Okay, now the active duty is coming here. You know, so now we're going to have to take a back seat to the active duty, you know, even though we're veterans and we've been here." You know, that's supposed to be the separation. And what you feel about that?
And the VA has always been for separated soldiers or military personnel. And it's always every time this happens, you're absolutely right. There's always a policy, oh, active duty in uniform, take priority.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it happen in the Air Force quite a bit, where
right.
there was a retiree hospital close to Travis Air Force Base that the Air Force absorbed, and suddenly it became a military hospital, where they changed all the policies, they changed the cost of stuff, they changed the insurance stuff, and they put up big signs everywhere, active duty in uniform takes priority. And they had you take a number, and if you were active duty in uniform, you had to go sign in, and you were ahead of all the people with numbers. And we're talking about people that were like 60, 70 years old, like World War II and Vietnam vets and stuff, and suddenly active duty uniform takes priority over these people with serious medical problems.
And there's a problem with that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the veterans, the retirees, and you know Vietnam vets, they have a very good gripe about that. Hey, you know, for y'all out there, for those out there that's veterans or in the military or spouses, hey, there's a book called Tears of a Warrior, A Family Story of Combat and Living with PTSD by Janet J. Seahorn, PhD, E. Anthony Seahorn, MBA. I highly suggest this book. You know, because it's very informative, and it'll let you know how to deal if you're dealing with someone that has PTSD. You know, it's a great book. You know, but getting back to what we're talking about, you know, and I don't know. I mean, but, you know, just reading that thing about the suicide, it really bothers me. It really does. I mean, thank God, you know, I'm in touch with my former soldiers and all of them still around, except for, you know, a few that were killed in combat. But, you know, they're still around, and I'm glad about that. You know, and that kind of makes me go back to think maybe it's the leadership, maybe. You know, what kind of leadership are they getting? Would you think that has a little bit to do with it?
I don't know about that. I think a lot of it is people are really scared to use the services that are available to them because they mm-hmm. say that there's a stigma, when really they're just not exercising their rights.
Hmm.
And that, I guess part of that's a leadership problem, like an education problem for people
right.
that don't understand what they can do to protect themselves against the stigma.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately it comes down to the military member. And I don't want to rag on the military because they do an important job, but in a lot of cases, you're not talking about the most educated people.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
On the one hand, you're recruiting people that, I don't like saying it, but people that really wouldn't succeed in the civilian world to begin with, and teaching them to kill. And on the other hand, you have this problem that people just really aren't talking about until it becomes a huge issue like it is now. And there's got to be a middle ground somewhere. And I think part of that is having education programs outside of tuition assistance for the military, because a lot of people coming in, they don't even have a high school diploma. They have their GED or even they don't even have that sometimes if they score high enough on their ASVAB.
Hmm.
So you're not talking about educated people sometimes that have critical thinking skills. They think, I don't like this, I'm suffering, I need a way out. And while a more rational person might say, oh, you know what, I'll just separate after my contract is up. You know, I'll deal with it until then, or I'll see a doctor about this on my off time so no one has to know. They say, oh, I'm just going to kill myself. So I'm sure that's a part of it and not the whole picture, but I think that's a serious problem, is the lack of education of some of the people in the military.
Okay. So we got, well, let's talk about the family, because some of it they say is financial as well. So what can we do about the home front? You know, because I agree with you on the part of you know, your wife leaving or your girlfriend leaving, that happens on a daily basis. I can't, you know, I really can't see that. Well, for some people, maybe. But I really can't see that. But I can see financially, because in some cases, you know, finances are the main thing why a lot of people got married. You know, so how can, is there any way we can work on that, like, you know, with the spouses? Well, that's going to be hard, too, because some spouses, you know, they're not real sociable, because a lot of them get married just for the social leave and don't know anyone.
I mean, in terms of financial stuff, I really don't agree with the financial reasons why soldiers kill themselves. Everyone in the military gets their housing paid for either through their housing allowance, or they live in barracks or dormitories. Mm-hmm. So they get essentially free housing. I don't know how it works in the Army, but in the Air Force, you either ate at the chow hall every day, or you got your basic allowance for sustenance, BAS.
Right.
So your food was paid for. So
right.
Your base pay was your take-home pay. And a lot of times you didn't pay state tax, but a lot of people said, oh, I'm a Texas resident, so they didn't have a state tax. So all they paid was federal taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you got deployed, you didn't even have to pay federal tax. So, and if you're overseas deployed, you got combat pay, you got hazard pay, you got a couple other bonus pay. So you're talking about people that are bringing home $3,000 a month plus BAS and BAH tax-free. So that's all disposable income.
Yeah, but you're still talking about the younger generation, though. You know, a lot of these people, you know, I'm saying a lot of them meet these little girls out in the economy or, you know, in a club somewhere. I'm sure you've seen it. And 2 or 3 weeks later, they married. And, you know, next day, you know, they getting deployed. You know, now this little girl got all it, you know, they done left a general power attorney to the little girl. You know, and while he's out fighting, she's clubbing, going bar hopping or whatever they do. And when he comes back, his money's gone.
Yeah, I've seen that happen a couple times, but there's already education in place. Every soldier knows about that kind of thing. It's not like, oh, I never heard about this before. Every soldier, before he's deployed, gets told about that kind of stuff. Don't give people general power of attorney. Always do a specialized power of attorney. If you're trying to sell your car and you get deployed, give someone you trust a special power of attorney just for your car. If you have a wife, or a girlfriend you want to give some money to, have her have a separate bank account, and you can do the direct deposit from the finance office, wherever you're at, and do a split disbursement. So with your paycheck, most of it goes into your account, and you give the rest of it to the girlfriend. It goes into two different accounts. So they already have a very good education in place for that. The problem is you have these people think, oh, my wife would never do that to me.
Exactly.
Like, you knew her for 3 weeks. You dated her for 3 weeks or a month before you got married. You don't even know her.
Exactly. But you left all your money and all your property.
And you know, they can stand everyone in formation, do not leave general power of attorney to anyone while you're deployed, and just yell at them and yell at them and yell at them and educate them and educate them and educate them, people will still do it.
Every day.
What's the phrase? You can't fix stupid?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, y'all had that same phrase, I see.
I mean, the first few people that this happened to, they say, okay, no one's ever heard of this phenomenon before. But after that, every person that gets deployed hears about this kind of thing. It's all part of the education process before you get deployed.
Right.
It doesn't matter how well you know your wife, your girlfriend, or even like your brother or your sister that you're giving these powers of attorney to. If once they have the power, they think, oh, he's not going to miss $100 here or there. And suddenly they know, it's, oh, he's got $10,000 in his account. I'm going to Vegas, baby.
Well, I'm going to get me another boyfriend. We're going to spend this together because
exactly.
They're here right now. Yeah.
They're living large on your paycheck. And you think, oh, I'm saving all this money. When I come home, I'm getting a car. I'm going to put a down payment on a house. You come back, they've cleaned you out. Not even, it doesn't have to be your girlfriend. It could be your mom. People's moms do this to them.
But,
like, oh,
yeah.
I raised you. You owe me this money. That's happened quite a bit. And people are like, oh, my brother would never do that to me. And you come home, and he's got a new Corvette, and your house has been sold.
I mean, what is it left to do? I guess some say, well, I might as well go on and take care of, you know, end the rest of it. But, I mean, is there really anything we can do for that?
The nasal spray.
Not
man,
really. Just the nasal spray.
You come back and you have this nasal spray every day, and you say, oh, you stole all my money. Fuck it, man. I feel great.
Now, I don't think the nasal spray is going to help with that. I mean, no, that's not, you know, that's not a great feeling at all. I can tell you that. So the nasal spray is not going to help. You know, but being that you are a veteran, tell me some of the symptoms or cases you've seen where your so-called buddies or what have you has said they had PTSD.
Well, there were two people I went to. It was an air base in Iraq, and combat didn't happen within 100 miles of this base. And all we did is we managed servers, like secure servers. We did the Predator feed, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure how much detail I'm allowed to go into because it was we handled classified.
Yeah, that's good enough right there. That's good enough.
We worked. Even though we were in Iraq, we were 100 miles away from any combat. We could leave the base and go to this huge shopping mall anytime we wanted, anytime we were off duty, I should say. We worked in an air-conditioned tent 12 hours a day, and after that, we could do whatever we wanted and unless we didn't come to work the next day. You know, we had a chow hall, but most people ate off base, and there was an AFI's there. They had Burger King. They had Popeyes. They had, I think they had a Subway towards the end. So these people have never seen combat. They weren't near combat. They didn't even have to do a drill where they had to get into the ditch. They didn't sound the alarm for drill, nothing.
Wow.
And
so where were you?
Two of these people came back and they said, oh, I've got PTSD. I was in Iraq. I was stressed. It's absolute fraud, but the VA just goes along with it because they don't have the resources to screen it out.
Well, okay. I mean, just because they said they had PTSD, they didn't show, you know, try and show any signs or symptoms or anything?
Well, I don't know exactly how they went about it because when I was separating, they have separation counseling, and the VA is a part of that. And they go, there,
right.
Do you have PTSD? And if you say yes, you fill out the claim paperwork, and you have to go see a doctor. And if the doctor says, oh, yeah, I agree, you have PTSD, then you get, I think it's automatic 50%. I think it's automatic 40%, and if you were injured any other way, then it gets bumped up quite a bit. So it's automatic 40%, so that's free VA care for the rest of your life, VA medical care, plus you get, I think, like 20% of your base pay every month for the rest of your life. So there's a huge incentive to commit this fraud, and there's not really a lot that they do to screen it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the one hand, it costs money to hire people to screen it out. But on the other hand, they can say, oh, we're helping this many people with PTSD. So they have an incentive to inflate their numbers. But on the flip side of that, they're paying out more money for that.
You're right.
So there's got to be some way to balance it. And the way to do that is to hire people, like independent investigators, to come in and investigate some of these cases, especially the Air Force and the Navy guys that never saw combat and sitting there saying, oh, I have PTSD. That's a very easy thing to figure out. And they go, oh, you were stationed on a ship in the middle of nowhere. You don't have PTSD. Your ship never saw combat. You don't have PTSD. I'm sorry. Or the same thing with the Air Force guys. You were deployed to Saudi Arabia. You never saw combat. Your unit never saw combat. The base you were at never saw combat. You don't have PTSD. I'm sorry. But they don't do that. They don't have a screening process like that. As long as you can go in and make yourself sound a little bit credible, you get the benefits for the rest of your life.
I wish it was that easy. Because it didn't come out that easy for me. I can tell you that much.
Well, for certain types of injuries, the VA has a vested interest in hiding them. If you actually get disabled, like if you actually get shot and you have to get a prosthetic, that's not something that America likes to brag about.
Yeah.
So they have a vested interest in kind of padding those numbers in the negative side. Like, oh, we only had 30 people get prosthetics this month, when really it should have been 100, 200, who knows? So they have a vested interest in keeping those numbers down, and they say, oh, we have this post-traumatic stress counseling, and we're helping our veterans, and they want those numbers to be high. On the flip side of that, the actual injuries, they're trying to downplay that.
Wow. Now, see, that's an angle I didn't even think about. And you're right. There's some things they do need to downplay because they don't want to know. You know what? And you're right, because there's some things they don't want the American public to know about what's going on. You're right about that. What we are actually coming back, you know, what we actually coming back having problems with, you know. And you know what? I was thinking about what you were saying about the females. And, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of them that, oh, yeah, you know, they use whatever they can to get out of deploying, or once they get over there, you know, to stay inside the wire, don't have to go anywhere. You know, and you're right. So maybe that is maybe a difference. You know, but once again, we have this thing right now where females are petitioning to be part of combat units. So you think we're going to change in that the statistics? Or would they work their way out of that as well?
Well, not all women do the kind of things that I described. There are some very successful women in combat. They have female gunners on the convoys now. They have the one of those rapid response repair crews that actually go out and repair IED damage so the teams can come back to base, and they take fire all the time. So while they can't be infantry and they can't be like forward combat stuff, they can do support roles that see combat.
Oh, yeah.
And so there are women that do that very successfully.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, you have women that only are in the military for the benefits, and those are the people that will try to get out of any way they can. And the others, on the flip side of that, they're just like the guys, there are people that are really in it to be in it. They really believe in God and country, and they want to make sure that September 11th never happens again. And
right.
That actually want to do the job. That's what they joined for. And there are definitely women like that that actually want to help their country. I hate to say it, but that's not the majority of women. But there are women, very successful women in combat roles, like support combat roles, but still in combat roles, that are out there. So I don't want to disparage all women. It just seems like it's easier for a woman to get out of a deployment than it is for a guy, is the point I was trying to make.
Yeah,
now, even if you get deployed, it's easier for a woman to get a cushier job than it is for a guy.
Right. And you know what? And you are absolutely right. But, you know, in my unit, it kind of became the opposite. It became the opposite because, you know, once the orders came down, there was no getting out. You know, like I said, you know, you may say, well, I'm pregnant. Well, you know, if we can get you, you going with us. You may have to, like you say, work in an office or somewhere, but you're going to be over there to a certain time. Then we may ship you back, just depending. You know, some say, well, that may be a waste of money. Maybe. But it's proven a point. You just can't do anything to get out of deploying. Now, don't get it wrong.
But you know when your deployment cycle's coming down. You can do it before you get orders. Like, I don't know how it happens in the Army, but in the Air Force, they have called an AEF rotation.
Uh-huh.
And if your AEF rotation was coming up, you would know months in advance.
Right.
So before you got your orders, you knew if you were on the hook to deploy or not.
Right, right.
And there's nothing in your contract saying, oh, you can't get pregnant. So that you would see a huge influx of people getting pregnant or having other medical conditions that would prevent them from deploying as their AEF rotation's coming up.
Wow.
But I don't know how that works in the Army, but that's how it works in the Air Force. You know when you're on the hook for deployment.
Right. Well, you're right. I mean, especially in the type of unit I was in, because we were gone, 6-7 months out of the year, come back for 2 or 3 months, and we were gone again. So, yeah, we knew what it was. Nah.
And so what was stopping the women of your unit from coming back and saying, oh, I was so happy to see my boyfriend, we didn't use protection, and now I'm pregnant, even though we got to deploy in 3 months, you know?
Well, you know,
I don't know anything about the women in your unit, but I'm just saying it's easier for that to happen.
Right. Well, I must admit, in my unit personally, we had some great females, you know, because they actually worked their butt off. You know, we really, I mean, because You know, I was. Where were you at in Iraq? Where were you? Your home base was.
It was about 100 miles away from Balad Air Base.
Okay, so we used to transport the big tanks. You know, the big trucks with the tanks on the back. That's what we did. So, you know, they had to ride with us all day and all night. And when we got in a battle, a firefight, they had to, you know, count on us. We had to count on them. So, you know, it was outstanding.
So that's what I'm saying. There are some women that do the job and do it well.
Mm-hmm. You're right. So, I don't know. We really... I don't know. I still think maybe there's something we need to check as far as the women. We need to really check out some what's going on with the women's chemistry. I mean, because for some reason they're coming back, even the ones that's out there in the foreign units. And some of these guys, you know, they're not doing as much as the females, but they're coming back and killing themselves, but the females aren't. So is there something in that their makeup that's making them less susceptible to suicide, or they just the build automatically just helps them handle things better?
Well, again, even when they come back, it's easier for a woman to have a support structure than it is for a guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're a guy and your wife leaves you while you're deployed, you come back and you got to go out and do the bar scene all over again, and that's hit or miss, as you know. Or you do online dating, and that takes months and months. And so you're not talking about you'll find instant companionship. If you're a girl and you go to the bar, you'll have guys hitting on you as soon as you walk in. And you have your pick of whoever you want at the bar that night. I mean,
wow.
So it's so much easier for a woman to get a support structure in place than it is for a guy.
Yeah.
Even if it's just a temporary one-night support structure.
You know what? Now, see, I never really gave that any thought like that. I really haven't. But that makes sense, though. That makes a whole lot of sense to a certain point, I would guess. You know, but even if that's the case, I mean, they still have their buddies. When you think their buddies... Well, now they're going through the same thing. And maybe that is the difference between men, the men and the women in services. You know, the men, we have that pride thing. And maybe we let that get in the way a lot.
I think that goes back to the stigma of people not wanting to use their benefits.
Or
it's only a stigma if you go out and tell people, like, oh, I'm seeing a psychiatrist. You don't you can see a psychiatrist and still keep your pride. You don't have to tell everyone your business.
Wow. I just got some breaking news. Comedian Phyllis Diller has died at the age of 95 at a home in Los Angeles. Wow.
Phyllis Diller.
Yeah, Phyllis Diller. You know, the comedian.
I've heard of him.
Yeah,
what was that guy today? He was the famous director, directed Top Gun. He killed himself today.
Yeah,
jumped
off a bridge
in Los Angeles.
Yeah. So I guess you could say it's not just military, huh? It's just.
Well, in his case, I understand what he was doing. Supposedly, he had inoperable brain cancer.
Oh.
So I can respect that. Instead of, you know, having a long, drawn-out, lingering, painful death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'd do the same thing. I mean, shit.
Well, I know I can't. that's a sensitive subject with me, so we're going to move on from that. Woo! Okay. Well, you know what? We got Mike online, y'all, and today is Open Mic Monday, and we're having a great conversation about our soldiers, PTSD, suicide, and just military veterans all together. So if you want to add anything to the conversation, you can dial in at 347-838-8622. Hit me at ericletstalk@gmail.com, or you can join me in my chat room. You know, this is Let's Talk. I am your host, Eric Jackson. We got an hour left to go, so let's get them phone lines going, and let's get some chat going. Oh, wow. But Mike, you know, you're bringing up some very good points. And you're right, though. If we're out there, we have those individuals out there that's beating the system, and basically that's what they're doing, you know, they're causing problems for others. And maybe this is the reason why a lot of them soldiers are coming back killing themselves. Like those soldiers in Colorado that went on the killing and robbing spree once they got back. You know, some of them guys get over there, and between the actual deed itself of going in, kicking in doors, being in firefights for so long, and maybe the video games, the combat game. What's the combat game? I don't play the game, so I really can't tell you. Not Mortal Kombat. Yeah, the army games, whatever. Maybe that plays a role in a lot of it. Maybe it kind of taints their behavior to a certain point where they, you know, without actually being in a combat zone or what have you, they can't take it. But the question is anyone really doing anything to see if that's a problem? Or are we waiting to after they kill themselves and say, okay, yeah, this is a problem, and this is what we need to do?
Well, this goes back to the nasal spray thing. I'm glad they're doing that, because up until 2009, they never really kept track of a month-by-month total of how many people were committing suicide. And they didn't even keep accurate records of even annual suicides until the mid-90s. So who knows how much of this of a problem this was for the Gulf War or for Vietnam or Korea or World War II or World War I or any other conflict we've ever had. We don't know how much of a problem that was, because we didn't keep accurate records.
You're right. You know, and I would think on a scale, I would think the Vietnam War would have been probably up on the same level than the Gulf War. I mean, because the Gulf War, let's really talk about it. The Gulf War really wasn't all that. I mean, it was a war, but it really wasn't all that. It was over too fast. You know, yes, we went some places we shouldn't have been, but it is what it is. You know, but I don't think the severity of what it did to anyone mentally can compare to Vietnam or, you know, the Iraq War, the war we have going on in Afghanistan. And maybe that is the reason why we are having these problems. With so much suicide. And you're right, that, you know, the young guys are the ones seen not being able to handle it. So maybe we need to pay more attention to that demographic once they return, or even before they return. You know, and who knows, you know, you're like we used to say, don't go up and try and drink up the whole town in one night. And maybe that has something to do with it. You know, alcohol consumption.
Now, that's a problem in itself, because the military is based on alcohol consumption. You're not going to combat that culture overnight.
Well, you're right. You're right. You know, but like we used to say, you know, make sure you take a non-drinking buddy with you, because you can't take a buddy with you if he's going to sit there and drink and try and out-drink you, because that's not going to solve the problem. You know, they're both of you sitting there drowning your sorrows and thinking about things and becoming more depressed. And maybe that has, you know, that is a part of it.
So, in the Air Force, when you get a promotion, you have
promotion party?
E5 and above, really, you have promotion ceremonies, and it happens once a year, basically.
Right.
So, when that happens, all the people that got promoted pitch in, and they buy the bar for the night. It's open bar for anybody that wants it, as long as they're over 21. Or if the legal age drinking age is younger for overseas, somewhere that something can be younger. But they buy up the bar for the night. Or anytime someone gets promoted to a higher officer like position, like a colonel or a lieutenant colonel or major, they buy out the bar for the night. That's their solution for a military celebration. So from the very beginning, they're fostering a culture of alcohol consumption. And then there's nothing wrong with an adult enjoying an alcoholic beverage. But when it's sponsored by the command, that's a problem with the culture of the unit. Or of the base, as the case may be. When I was in Japan when I got promoted to E5, and I didn't even realize that this happened because I really didn't attend promotion ceremonies and stuff like that. So I was always able to take leave for those days. I don't like the official ceremony. But I didn't realize how many people would be there in their service dress uniforms getting shit-faced drunk. At the E-Club, the Enlisted Club, and then they'd drive home.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
But I like taking the drink as much as the next guy, but I do it on my own time, and I do it with my own money, and I don't do it to excess.
Mm-hmm.
And not everyone's like that. Not everyone's that responsible, but I think this is one of those things where it is the leadership that's the problem, because they're sitting there saying, oh, every time there's a celebration, we'll just all go get drunk together. So in terms of the alcohol consumption being a problem for the military, I agree, and I think that is a leadership issue.
Okay.
Is that how they did it in the Army? When you got promoted,
well,
you bought out the bar?
Well, you know what? It used to be that way. But, you know, when you start having how can I put it? When you start having certain people get DUIs leaving, you know, the general celebration and what have you, then yes, there's an issue. So, no, they cut it out after a while.
Well, the Air Force didn't even start taking DUIs seriously until 2007.
2007.
There was a guy in my very first unit. It was in Travis Air Force Base in California. He had four DUIs before he even got his first non-judicial punishment.
Really?
Four DUIs.
Wow. Four DUIs.
And now, if you get a DUI, it's more serious. But
right. Well, you know what?
In 2007, they didn't care. As long as you didn't kill a military member or really get in real serious trouble off base, they didn't care.
You're right. You're right. You are absolutely right. Well, you know, it didn't really become that serious, you're right, until later on. Because after a while, that was the military all about, drinking. But when you got young soldiers coming in today that really haven't, I guess you can say, lived or did anything like that, that's not the right, I guess, environment to expose them to. Especially after coming back off a long, hard tour? No. I can't see it. And maybe, like I said before, maybe that is leading to the problem. Contributing to the problem. I won't say leading, contributing to the problem.
Yeah, alcoholism is definitely a contributing factor in some of these suicides.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, and now we have to... we just need to sit back and figure out what can we do, though. Okay, we know we're working on the nasal spray. That's fine. But what are we going to do about it in the meantime? Some say it's PTSD. There's really nothing you do unless they get some help. No, that's fine and dandy, too. But what about them soldiers coming back before they get the chance to see a psychiatrist or psychologist, you know, to get that help or that medication prescribed? That they do need. So what do we do before that?
Well, you have to have more doctors in your overseas locations, and they're not going to do that.
You know what? I'm glad you brought. Why not? Why not?
Well,
they
because their doctors.
They got everything else over there.
They do have medical facilities over there, but they don't have like mass. They don't have the facility that you would have back in the United States, or like a large base overseas.
Well, yeah, that's
so
true.
Like the base that I was at, they had two doctors for the entire base. And they had a nice building that they worked out of, but that's two doctors for a couple thousand people.
Right. But see, and once again, my point exactly. You got everything else over there. Why not go on and get the doctors over there that's needed to help maybe prevent some of this tragedy that's going on once these soldiers get back?
Because it's hard for the military to recruit doctors. they've had to take some ridiculous steps to recruit doctors in recent years.
Mm.
Because it used to be kind of a prestigious thing. You know, you did your time in the service, and you know that used to look good on your resume, or if you had your own practice, like, oh, he used to be in the military. You know, people saw that as a character builder.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And nowadays, being in the military is stopping doctors from making the money that they should be making in the civilian sector. They might have $250,000 worth of medical bills or medical loans for medical school, but they'll make that back the first year or second year they're out of medical school if they don't live like assholes. You know, they don't need a Lexus their very first year out of med school, you know?
Right.
So if they actually live within their means, they can pay off it, and they actually get a decent job, which most doctors do. You can pay off your medical bill, your medical school loans, in the first couple years that you've graduated from medical school, if you just buckle down and pay it. Or you can spread that out over 20 years if you buy a nice house and a nice car. I'm talking like multi-million-dollar stuff here, and you spread out the loan payments for all that stuff for a little bit longer, but you still have the lifestyle that you want. And if you're in the military, you're an officer, and you get officer pay. And that, compared to actual civilian sector doctor pay, that's peanuts.
You know,
you get paid $5,000 a month as a colonel. Guess what? You'd be making $20,000 a month if you had your own practice. Or if you work for like an HMO, like Kaiser Permanente out here in California, they have their own doctor staff and all the equipment under one roof. You work for a place like that, you'll make, I don't know, $1 million a year. You're not going to make that kind of money in the Air Force or in the military. You're just not.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you
so
know, that's not the first time I've heard
doctors
that.
Because they just don't pay well enough. And so what they've started doing in recent years is they're taking doctors and saying, oh, well, if you enlist in the military, I don't know if it's other branches of the military or not, but specifically the Air Force, if you enlist in the Air Force and become an officer, well, you'll automatically become an officer. You want to go through basic training or officer training school, and we'll pay your school loans. We'll pay 100% of your school loans, and we'll pay your base pay and all the other pay you're entitled to. And all you have to do is sign a 3-year contract with us. So really, all they're doing is signing away 3 years of their life for the military and getting multi-hundred-thousand-dollar loans repaid, plus getting $5,000 a month base pay, whatever officer level they're at.
Right.
And, you know, a nice house on base, working in a medical squadron, which is just a cushy squadron, like a cushy position as a doctor. And, you know, they're still not drawing the amount of people that they want to be doctors, even with 100% loan repayments. And I think they're going to take the number of years they have to sign down to 2 or even maybe 1, to get more doctors. But as far as doctors go, even if you have doctors overseas, you still have bases back stateside that have to have doctors there. And you have a hospital on every major Air Force base and every major Army base that still has to be staffed with doctors. So even if you take some of those doctors and take them overseas, you still have to staff the hospital. So you have to basically have double the amount of doctors to have the same facilities in deployed locations.
Okay, so, I mean, we okay, now here's where the problem comes in at. Okay, so we contract out everything else. Why not contract some doctors?
Another problem I have with the military, and that's TRICARE. The military owns the land the hospitals are on. They own the hospitals. They own the equipment. They pay the doctors a base pay, and yet somehow we still have insurance involved in that.
Somehow, huh?
Because
I like that.
The cost of treatment, if you go to the military hospital and get an x-ray, the cost of that is literally the cost of the film they use to x-ray. Because whether you go to the hospital or not, the doctor's still getting his base pay. The x-ray techs are still getting their base pay. So really, the only cost of getting that x-ray, after they have to pay off they pay the cost of the x-ray machine, so once that's paid, they own it. So the only cost is the film that they use to do the x-rays on. But instead of just saying, oh, that's the cost, they brought in TRICARE and they're saying, oh, no, an x-ray, that's actually worth $300. Even though the film, you buy that for $10 at a medical supply company, they say, oh, no, the x-ray is $300. And, you know, any other treatment, they say, oh, that's this amount of money. And so TRICARE handles all that stuff now. So when you're talking about outsourcing doctors, not only do you have to pay more than just the base pay for a military doctor, then you have TRICARE getting involved and saying, oh, no, there's contract stuff you got to do. And they have to take our insurance, which is TRICARE. And no doctor wants TRICARE. I live in Palmdale, California, and that's really Edwards Air Force Base. And there's a lot of retirees out here. They have to go to the Edwards Air Force Base Hospital because there's no city hospital that takes TRICARE. The government TRICARE insurance is such a hassle that it's not even worth the doctor's time to take TRICARE money.
Wow. That's a good point. That's a good point. So it's not just one single thing. Then there's a whole complex system of things that we need to change to help combat this thing, to try and get the trend changed, basically we're saying.
And that can never happen until they reform military contracts, government contracts, how those work.
Well, you know that one hand washes the other with that.
Pardon?
I say, you know, that's one hand washes the other one with military contracts, basically, or the cheapest man up.
Because once you start talking about, oh, we have to get a civilian company to contract out to, then you'll have these companies that already have doctors on staff putting in these really low bids, and then they'll come back and say, oh, wait, we realized we didn't think you'd be sending us as much traffic. This is what it's really going to cost, and then it's going to inflate 1,000% higher.
You're right.
Then you're talking about paying even more than you're already paying for medical care.
Wow. You know, so and there's the rub right there. You know, it's just too much involved. But we got to, not just us veterans, but as a nation, community, country, whatever you want to say, we got to do something, man, because we can't keep losing these soldiers. You know, like I mentioned before, you know, they go and they survive whatever they do during the war, then they come home and can't take whatever they're going through here and taking their own lives. You know, regardless of what you may think, there's still somebody's son, husband, daddy, you know, father, however you look at it. And that's a tragic thing to have. It really is. You know, we've discussed a lot of things that really needs to be fixed. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Probably I was just going to say, in the United States, the average amount of suicides per 100,000 people is about 20. And that's predominantly men. It's like 17.5 men per 100,000 and like 4.2 women per 100,000. So even in the civilian population, women's suicides are far, far less common than male suicide.
The male suicide, right.
But that's per 100,000 per year. And you're talking about just in the Army in July, how many?
Just in the Army, 26 active duty soldiers in July alone.
Plus the ones they're investigating as potential not
suicides. Well, that's the, yeah.
I mean, for the year. They've already passed the national standard for suicides in 1 month.
In 1 month. Yes.
Yeah. I would agree that's a problem.
Yeah, that's a big problem. You know, that is a very big problem. You know, and, you know, it's fine. They're reporting it. They're tracking it. And now they decided to see about a nasal spray. That's good, too. But my question still goes back. What about now? What are we going to do about our soldiers returning now? You know, the Internal Defense Department document that revealed that there had been 154 suicides in the first 155 days of the year, through June the 3rd.
Jesus.
And this is that active duty military now.
And that's not even the Guard or Reserve that's over there.
No. This is just active duty.
I would think not the National Guard, but the reservists over there have more of a reason than the active duty guys, because they're the guys that already have good jobs. They're the people that have $75,000 or $100,000 a year jobs, suddenly getting that reduced to base pay.
Right.
So they're the ones that are losing their houses and losing their cars because they're not getting their paycheck anymore. They're getting just the government paycheck, and they can't afford to have the lifestyle they had before. So they're the ones that are losing everything because of the government. So I think those people would be more at risk.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and looking at this, according to the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, a private organization that provides support for military members and their families, said counseling and other forms of care for emotionally distraught military members is often too little, too late. And others never seek help out of fear over how others will view seeking treatment. That's just crazy. So, I mean, okay, so we know there's a problem. Okay, and we have taken the steps, but like I said, that's in the future, 3 years in the future. What about now? We know this is going on. 154 suicides in 155 days. If that's not a problem, I don't know what is. And that's not counting, see, and here's the thing, that's not counting the 26th in July.
And you said that was an internal document. So that's not even something they even intended for public release.
Right. Exactly.
So I still think they have a vested interest in keeping suicide numbers swept under the rug. They don't want the public to know because they really don't have a plan for it. But we see this kind of thing all the time from the military and even from the VA. We were talking about the Gulf War earlier. Have you ever heard something called Gulf War Syndrome?
Yeah. Yeah, I heard about it.
Out of about 700,000 veterans that served in the Gulf War, about 250,000 are believed to be affected with Gulf War Syndrome. And the VA to this day is saying, oh, it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist because they don't want to have to pay out the money. And it's kind of a stigma for the military. They're saying that these people are overseas doing the job and they don't even know what caused it.
And that's the scary part. But yet they don't know what caused it. But yet they're saying it doesn't exist.
Exactly, because they have a vested interest. They want to keep their recruitment numbers good. They want to keep their public image squeaky clean as much as they can. So they have a serious interest in keeping the suicide numbers unknown to the public, and even in terms of the other kind of stuff like injury rates and like things like that, they want to keep those artificially low.
Artificially low. Wow.
Well, I'll give you another example. One of the guys that I mentioned earlier, I knew a guy that killed himself when I was stationed at Travis Air Force Base. Uh-huh. And this was before the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, so it was still in effect. He was very obviously a flaming homosexual.
Okay.
But he didn't say anything about it. He had to talk, and he walked. He even walked the walk a little bit. He had a pride sticker on his car. But he never mentioned it at all. And his supervisor saw the pride sticker on his car and went kind of hammered him. Like, are you homosexual and all this stuff? And he's like, well, you're not allowed to ask and I'm not allowed to tell. But after that started happening, he killed himself. And it was very obviously a suicide. But when they did the investigation, they said, oh, it was an accident. He fell. He was in his bathroom and he fell.
Hmm. Wow. Okay.
And that's actually true. He was sitting. He had his toilet seat down and the lid down. He was sitting on his toilet. He overdosed on pills, and after he was unconscious, he fell off the toilet and hit his head on the floor and bled out. So they said the official cause of death was blood loss. They didn't mention that he had like 3,000% of the normal level of benzodiazepines and tricyclic antidepressants in his system that he used.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dude. Wow.
So they said it was obviously a suicide to anyone with a brain. Even you don't even have a brain to look at it. Oh, he was high on pills. He was trying to kill himself. But they said, oh, it's blood loss. Blood loss.
Wow. You know, and how long, you know, I guess it's going to go on as long as we have individuals up there with ulterior motives. But how long does these things have to go on before somebody realizes, hey, we need to change something because it's not working. You know, we need to quit hiding things. You know, if somebody's going to join, somebody's going to join regardless of what's going on. know, the parents may have a problem with it, but at a certain age, it's not the parents' decision whether, you know, they're going to join or not anyway. So you might as well let them know what the problems are or what they may be facing.
Well, that, you know, that goes into the cutting of the recruitment numbers. The recruiters will lie to you to get you to join. You know it, and I know it.
Yeah, you're right about that one. Wow. You know.
And in terms of letting people know what's really going on, if you're an active duty military member and you let people know what's going on, they call you a whistleblower.
And that's a nice word. That's a nice word for it.
And they call you rats and all, and they all get stitches and all that. This is a true story that happened to me until I was able to resolve the issue, right? I was at my first base. I was handling the computers. I was in charge of $1 million worth of laptops. I had them locked in. We had a warehouse. I had them locked up in cases, and I had receipts for everyone that had a laptop signed out. I had it locked down. Someone broke into the warehouse and stole the laptops and some of the telephone equipment we had, but because they were signed out on my name, they said, oh, you're responsible for that. And
wow.
My commander is like, oh, you're responsible for this $1 million loss. I sat down and I did the math. Even if I made the chief, the highest enlisted rank, it would have taken me more than my lifetime to pay off that debt.
Right.
So I said to myself, I'm not taking the fall for this. So I went to the inspector general and said, someone broke into the warehouse. It was clearly a break-in. The military police came, and they call them security forces in the Air Force. The security forces came, they did their investigation, concluded in their official report that someone broke into the warehouse. So it's not like I was negligent and just handed this shit out to anybody, or I took them home and sold them and they found them on eBay, you know?
Right.
That's not what happened. So as soon as I went to the inspector general was required to go to the commander and say, we've had someone under your command come to us to initiate an investigation. And I was a rat. Because I didn't want to pay $1 million for equipment that I didn't steal. And that affected me for most of my career. That's one of the other reasons I got out. It wasn't the main reason, but it was one of the reasons I got out. Because after that, you know, it wasn't – even when I got it pulled out from my permanent file, they call it a permanent information file.
Right.
PIF, even when I got that pulled out of my PIF by the Judge Advocate General, you know, my first sergeant from my first base called my first sergeant at my next base. And this guy, he went to the inspector general.
Yeah. Now, everybody's watching you. Then make sure they're doing everything right on you because you done told on somebody.
Anytime there was a shit job, guess who got pulled for it?
Yeah.
Just because I was protecting myself.
And you know what? Maybe, and now that we're on that subject, you know, I thinking about that and witnessing some of that myself, you know, maybe that is kind of some of the issues some of these soldiers are having once they get back, too. You know, because we both know there's some things that goes over on over there that, you know, not exactly right. So maybe some of these soldiers are, you know, being honest and doing the right thing. And, you know, just can't take the pressure after they do it. Because somebody else is, how can I put it, pulling a tail, per se. You know, I mean, I guess if we're considering everything else, we would have to consider that as well. I mean, being that you brought it up.
I think that's definitely a factor for some of it. There's a lot of things that I hear. I was not a combat troop. I was a tech guy. But there are things that you hear, like those Marines, that Marine unit that was accused of going into people's houses in Iraq and holding the men at gunpoint and making the women strip naked and then raping the women in front of the men. I mean, some of that's propaganda from the enemy, but
but some of it's not.
You know, as someone that never actually saw combat over there and never you know, was doing the frontline stuff, I don't know how common that is. I don't even know how accurate that is, but some of it's accurate. Because that's the kind of stuff that we did in World War II. That's the kind of stuff we did in Vietnam. And, you know, war is not a pretty thing, But on the flip side of that, there are some soldiers that take that a little too far, and
yeah,
stuff happens. And if you go and report that later, you're a rat.
Ah, and once again, that's where we end up in trouble at. Hmm. You know? And
it's not even something like what happened to me. Like, it's a matter of $1 million, and, you know, there might have been some question who broke in or something, whatever. But you're talking about something that's obviously wrong, that obviously if it got out, it would be a stain on the military. It would ruin the military even further in the public image. And they just, instead of wanting to fix the problem, they're saying, oh, this guy's a rat, and just trying to ruin his life to get him to shut the hell up.
Yeah. So what? I'm curious now. Whatever happened with the laptop? Did they find out?
I talked to the Judge Advocate General and it's public defense. I forget the acronym now, but I had to sign a bunch of paperwork. I had to take a polygraph test from some guys from Fort Huachuca came out. And did a polygraph test because some of the laptops were rated for classified information.
Oh, okay.
And finally, after they couldn't find, they investigated me, they contacted my family, they did everything to put the focus on me. And finally, what the base commander had to do, he came down to my command and said, no, your entire squadron is going to be on basically 24-hour shifts until these laptops show back up. And
they're
within
great.
24 hours of that happening, miraculously, someone broke back into the warehouse and the laptops were all back.
Imagine that.
It was magic.
Yeah.
They were sitting there telling me, oh, you did it. You stole them. I'm the single guy living in basically a studio apartment on base. They call them dormitories, but it was a studio apartment on base. Where the hell am I going to hide $1 million worth of laptops? I didn't even have a car at the time. I lived a block away, a block away from where I worked. I could literally walk to work. If I had to go anywhere on base, it was a 5 or 10 minute walk. I didn't need a car. If I wanted to go off base, I could take the bus. So what would I do? Take the off base bus with $1 million worth of laptops?
Really? I'm that smart, right? Oh my goodness, you man. You know, but you know what? And just look. Looking at your situation and seeing how quickly, I can say, people turned on you. You know what I mean? How all of a sudden you were the enemy. You know, I can imagine what some of these young soldiers are going through. And then to come home and be faced with whatever they was faced with at home. Well, you know, yeah.
Even if they don't come forward, and everyone, and even if they're not labeled a rat, they still got to live with that.
Right.
You're like,
wow.
Well, I participated in atrocities.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of these kids, you know, gathering from the age range, you know, a lot of them have never been away from home before anyway. So now, you know, they're conditioned, and we're not going to say brainwashed, but conditioning is a great word because that's what we are once we join the military. We're conditioned to be certain, act certain ways, be certain ways. You know, we just discipline or condition to do this.
And even the oath you take when you enlist to follow the orders of the officers and sergeants appointed over you.
Right. So, you know, the conditioning starts then. So to go through all this and then all of a sudden to come home and, you know, in a kind of way, it's like having an idle mind. You're so used to going and doing and having something to do. You're home. And now, as you mentioned before, everything is beginning to come back to you. You can't sleep at night. You know, everything you do, you know, you want everything dark. You don't want to be bothered. You know, after a while, for some of these young kids, it's just unbearable. But, and now here's the question. So if it's not being noticed by leadership, I'm hoping. No, if there's any leaders out there listening or what have you, I'm hoping that there's some education being done for the families or whoever, you know, the make sure they're looking out for certain things. Because now And it took me a while. It took me a while to realize I was going through my little issues. You know, because I came back like, okay, I'm fine, da-da-da. But little things had changed with me as well. But I didn't know it because, to me, everything was fine. But
You say you did tank convoy duty?
Yeah, yeah.
Convoy duty is some of the most dangerous stuff in Iraq.
Yeah, I took the tanks up to the front line. I put the tank on the back of my truck, and I took them where they needed to go. That's what I did.
I've heard from a lot of different people that were doing combat, like frontline combat stuff, that convoy duty was the most dangerous duty in Iraq.
Oh, yeah.
Because they had they knew your routes. They knew the roads. They had time to place bombs on the roads in your route.
Right, right.
They're local. They know the city better than you do.
Better you do. So they force you to turn. And the truck I drove is a huge truck, so you just can't turn it around anywhere. So, you know, they force you down roads. You're like, oh, this is going to be trouble. So you see it coming before, you know, you see it coming. But my point is, you know, if there wasn't someone there that actually paid attention to my actions and the way I was acting compared to when I left, no telling where I would be right now. You know, so, you know, families need to be on the lookout as well. It's just not the military. You know, the families need to be out on the lookout and push them soldiers to try and get some help. I had a friend who was injured over there, and to this day, he still hasn't gotten any help. Right now, he's divorced. Don't nobody know where he is. You know, and he's just out there. You know, and you know, everybody tried to get him, you know, go and get some help, and he just refuses. So it's got to be something out there, some kind of way we can help these soldiers. Well, you know, thank God, as far as I know, he hasn't done anything to himself. But looking at these statistics for just the month of July as far as suicide, and, you know, that is just something that is unacceptable. If we the biggest and the best nation, the biggest and the best army in the world, while our soldiers come back killing themselves, they're killing themselves more than the enemy are killing them. That's not right.
Bill, I wouldn't disagree that we're the best, but to say that we're the biggest army, that's not accurate. China has a million-man standing army.
You're right. Well,
North Korea
has
a bigger one than that. So
yeah.
I agree we're the best. We're the best equipped. We're the best trained.
Okay. Yeah.
Certain ways,
let me reword it then. You're
kind
right.
Kind of nitpicky thing, I know, but
yeah, they have huge, yeah. But my point is, you know, if we are all this, then we need to do something now. You know, I understand we got things in work for three years from down, 2.5, 3 years down the road, but we need to do this now because this is happening now. You know, if we in June we're like a death a day almost. Yeah, almost a death a day. And now I'm sure we over that with July's numbers. No telling what's happening in August. You know, somebody needs to look into this thing that's going on.
I think a good part of it though is callousness from the. I'm not talking about like military leadership. I'm talking about the civilian leadership of the military now.
Mm-hmm.
Like the secretaries of the different organizations and. Like even maybe the Joint Chiefs, they look at it from a manpower standpoint, and you know the military fiscal year starts in October. So
correct.
Once October comes around, the recruiters, you know, they go out and they have to fill all these new recruit slots for the fiscal year, but with the economy the way it is right now, they fill up those slots in the first 2 months of the fiscal year, then they just coast until next October. So even if suicide rates tripled, they still get more people than they know what to do with wanting to join the military.
And you know what? And we have to look at the other side of that as well. Now, as far as you know, at just after Saudi, you know, the Gulf War, you know, once everything was said and done, the army all of a sudden. You got to go. You don't meet certain criteria. You got to go. We downsizing. We doing this. And a lot of them soldiers, a lot of the people, that's all they know is military. So now you forcing them out, and they don't know anything else. You know. So this is that's another huge culture shock for them, which probably could lead to some suicide as well. No, it's just, you know, now, you know, the more we talk and you know mention certain things, the more the different nuances come in about what actually is behind some of these deaths. Now, of course, you know, they're not going to really tell us, you know, per se, but I'm sure that has a lot to do with it, a whole lot to do with it.
And especially, I don't want to talk badly about the Army, but it's a less technical side than other branches like the Navy and the Air Force. You know, I did computers for 10 years in the Air Force. That's a technical skill that I can take to a real company. Infantry guys in the Army, unless you get a job as a security guard, that's not really a translatable skill. You have to go back to school to get another skill to be able to hold a real job. I'm not talking like minimum wage at McDonald's. I'm talking like if you want to actually have a livable wage, you have to go back to school for that. You have to learn a trade for that, and infantry is not a trade.
You're right. And as you mentioned before, a lot of those guys in infantry, they didn't finish. A lot of them didn't finish high school. You, like you said, they have GEDs. So,
yeah.
And I mean, that's all they know. You know, and everybody's not able or, say, mentally capable of going back to school and learning something new. I mean, let's be honest about it. And
especially
a lot of those guys,
they can't sleep at night because they're having nightmares.
Right. You know, I was lucky enough to where I could go. You know, I went to school online. You know, went to college online, which worked perfectly for me because I didn't have to go out and be bothered with nobody. You know, and I think that's why a lot of these online colleges are popping up now for that. You know, taking advantage of that. But is that really a good thing now? Because some of these soldiers, they need to get out and go into be in somebody's classroom. If not just for the camaraderie and see that everything is okay. Because you never know who you'll meet instead of trying to, you know, seclude yourself like I did. You know, I have no qualms about what was happening to me because I was secluding myself. I was drinking a fifth of gin every night, and I was just, I was just me. You know, and that was my routine.
I would like to mention something else. It's not what we were just talking about, but you brought up online colleges, and a lot of I don't know who's listening, but this is a huge problem in the United States. A lot of online colleges now are not accredited by a legitimate accrediting organization.
Right.
Like, I looked into this. University of Phoenix, even. And it's the biggest one. You hear, oh, University of Phoenix online. They don't hire people to teach their classes that have their degree. You can't get a degree from University of Phoenix, like a teaching degree from University of Phoenix, and then teach at University of Phoenix. Their degree is not good enough for them to hire you as a teacher. So while I might look good on a resume, if you actually want to go to a real college, that's not University of Phoenix. It's not like it's not DeVry University. It's not ITT Tech. A lot of those are for-profit organizations that prey on people that want to go to college, but have jobs that have income so they can afford to pay higher class tuition stuff. And their target market is people that just wanted another degree and they can put it on their resume and get a better job later on. If they have if anything that's technical, it's not good to get an online degree, especially for these for-profit organizations.
Yeah. And, you know, they basically target a lot of military because the military have what? GI Bill.
GI Bill, exactly. That's kind of why I wanted to mention it because it's a predatory type thing.
Right. So, you know, and I
didn't want to derail the conversation, but I always feel that's
no,
important.
I mean, that's good. I mean, that's what it's Open Mic Monday, man. We talk about whatever and anything. But you know what? That's good you mentioned that because I have always had a problem with them anyway because I'm like, You know how you get that little gut feeling like something not right? And I've heard a lot of the students complain about it. So, you know, I mean, when you have your students complaining, you're like, You know, no, something's not right. Something's not right.
Well, this is one of my favorite stories to tell. I was looking into going to ITT Tech because, you know, I was a computer guy, and while I have 10 years of work experience, I don't have any degrees.
Okay.
So I thought, I'll go to ITT Tech. I'll get a tech degree, and I'll be able to get a computer job in the real world. So I went into one of their campuses, And I talked to one of the guys that was actually a professor for one of the technical classes. He couldn't check his email.
Wow.
He said, I'm trying to log into the computer. I don't know how to log in and check my email. It's a simple username and password. And this is the guy that's going to teach me technology?
That is scary. That really is scary. Like, okay, well, you go and sit out there and let me teach this class, because apparently I know more than you do. Wow.
But I walked out, and I'll never go back to ITT Tech, even just to look at it again. You see those commercials, like, oh, ITT Tech has helped me have the life I want. Those are
right.
All accurate.
No, they're not. They're actual students. That's what you are supposed to believe. That is what they say.
But it
they're
says
actual
the,
students.
At the very end, it has a little asterisk. These were just actors or whatever.
Yeah. That is wild. You know, hey, y'all, if y'all listening, you know, it's not somebody, it's something somebody heard. You know, we've been through it. We know what we're talking about just a little bit, but we know. So if y'all listening, Mike, man, I want to thank you for a great conversation and a great show today. And
thanks
hey,
for
join me,
me
tomorrow, man. And anytime, you welcome to come back and we can chat it up. OK.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. I want to thank Mike today for a great show. And, you know, we both brought up some great points. So if you have a member of your family or a soldier in somewhere in a distant family and you think there may be some problems, man, make sure you get them some help, okay? Because as we read, the suicide rate is just outrageous right now for military. And we need to do something to stem that tide and get our young people back to living their lives normal and free. Okay? Now, once again, there's a book, if you have any questions about PTSD, called Tears of a Warrior, A Family Story of Combat and Living with PTSD, by Janet J. Seahorn, PhD, E. Anthony Seahorn, MBA. And it's a great book. And, I mean, it covers everything for the Vietnam veteran, Gulf War, all kind of things. You know, if you want to try and purchase a book, you can go to Team Pursuits, care of Tony and Jan Seahorn, 3534 Harbor Way, Fort Collins, Colorado, 80524. You know, area code 970-224-2425. tchorn @AT&T.net. Or you can go to the website www.tearsofawarrior.com. Now, I'll put this up in the chat room in a few minutes. So, you know, if you even want to copy it down and contact them about the book, feel free. You know, well, that's the show for today. I do once again thank you for listening. Thanks, Mike, for a great show and great information. And I'm going to leave you with something Kevin Coolidge said. The nation which forgets its defenders will itself be forgotten. And with that, y'all have a great day, and I'll see y'all tomorrow. I'm out of here.